Krishna. So we are very happy to welcome again this afternoon His Holiness Giriraj Swami Maharaj. So devotees who have heard Giriraj Maharaj's classes before know that he has a special way of narrating his experiences with Srila Prabhupada, and some of the most amazing remembrances of the time spent with Srila Prabhupada in Mumbai. We heard a few months back when Maharaj was here at Chowpatty, and he had brought the narration to a certain point, and the devotees were just wondering when the next dose of mercy will happen. So today he is going to continue from that point onwards also, of how ISKCON spread in India, especially the way Srila Prabhupada spent maximum amount of time here in Mumbai, and he was a direct witness of all the activities and leelas and pastimes which happened with Srila Prabhupada and his devotees from America. So we are very happy that along with some philosophy from the Nectar of Devotion, he's also going to be sharing some of those remembrances and experiences. And we are very happy, Maharaj, that you shared so much of nectar yesterday evening by speaking about Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. It was one of the most brilliant descriptions of the 10th canto all the devotees have heard here for a long time. Let us express our gratitude to His Holiness Giriraj Swami Maharaj by very loudly chanting Hari Bol. His Holiness Giriraj Swami Maharaj ki jai.
Krishna. It is a great pleasure to be here again. Krishna consciousness is a great science, and if properly understood and executed, it can produce wonderful effects for the individual, of course, and even for the society. The basic book of transcendental knowledge is the Bhagavad Gita. And the next book, in terms of advancement of study of the science, is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, or the Nectar of Devotion. In Sanskrit texts, there is one verse in each work that is considered to be the verse that governs all other verses in the scripture, called the Paribhasa Sutra. And every verse within the work has to be understood in relation to the Paribhasa Sutra. So I have chosen to speak today on the Paribhasa Sutra of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is the complete science of devotional service. So in order to understand what is bhakti, we have to understand this definition. Because bhakti now has become a very popular term. Yoga has become very popular. And then within yoga, now kirtan has become popular. And And the idea of bhakti has also become popular. But very few people know what bhakti actually is. So I thought it prudent to discuss what is bhakti as defined by Srila Rupa Goswami with reference to earlier authorities and scriptures. So please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I will recite the verse. Anya bilasita sunyam.
Anya bilasita sunyam.
Jnana karma dhyanavritam.
Jnana karma dhyanavritam.
Anukulyena krishnanu.
Anukulyena krishnanu.
Shilanam bhaktirutama.
Shilanam bhaktirutama.
Recite each Sanskrit word or phrase, and you can repeat after me, and then the translation of that word or phrase, and you can repeat that as well. Anya abhilasita shunyam. Translation. When first class devotional service develops, one must be devoid of all material desires. Knowledge obtained by monistic philosophy and fruitive action. The devotee must constantly serve Krishna favorably as Krishna desires. Now you can repeat. When report by Srila Prabhupada. This verse is found in Srila Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.1.11. As we can understand from the Bhagavad Gita 9.34 and 18.65, the Supreme Personality of Godhead wants everyone to think of Him always. Manmana bhavamad bhakta. Everyone should become his devotee, not the devotee of a demigod. Everyone should engage in his devotional service, including archana, deity worship in the temple. Manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyajimam namaskuru. Everyone should offer obeisances from moment to moment to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These are the desires of the Supreme Lord, and one who fulfills his desires favorably is actually a pure devotee. The criterion is that a devotee must know what Krishna wants him to do. This understanding can be achieved through the medium of a spiritual master who is a bona fide representative of Krishna. Srila Rupa Goswami advises, Ado Guravashrayam. One who is serious in wanting to render pure devotional service to the Lord must take shelter of a spiritual master who comes in the disciplic succession from Krishna. Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo vidu. Without accepting a bona fide spiritual master coming in the disciplic succession, One cannot find out the real purpose of devotional service. Therefore, one has to accept the shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and agree to be directed by him. The first business of a pure devotee is to satisfy his spiritual master, whose only business is to spread Krishna consciousness. And if one can satisfy the spiritual master, Krishna is automatically satisfied. Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasada. This is the success of devotional service. This is the meaning of the word anukulyena, that is, favorable devotional service to the Lord. A pure devotee has no plans other than those for the Lord's service. He simply wants success in the progress of devotional service. He is interested only in satisfying Krishna. If one lives only for the satisfaction of Krishna, it does not matter whether he belongs to this order of life or that order of life. One's only business should be to satisfy Krishna. This process is completely manifest in the activities of the Krishna consciousness movement. It has been actually proved that the entire world can accept devotional service without failure. One simply has to follow the instructions of the representative of Krishna. Anya bilasita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam anukulyena Krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttama. Now, for people born in the Vedic tradition, it may be natural or easy to accept the culture of Krishna consciousness. But why should someone not born in the Vedic culture do so? The answer is that the constitutional position of the living entity is that he is the eternal servant of God or Krishna. It doesn't matter whether one's body is black or white or yellow or male or female or old or young, or whether one by tradition or faith is Hindu or Christian or Muslim or agnostic or atheistic. But the nature of the pure soul is to love God and serve God. And every bona fide scripture of the world will teach that one should love God. When I grew up, became quite religious, and I would regularly go to the Jewish temple on Friday nights. And my favorite prayer says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy might." And that one should always think of the commandments of the Lord while lying down, while rising up. And one should teach the commandments to one's children. Of course, the original is much more beautiful than what I've paraphrased. But the idea is to love God and be fully conscious of Him and His commandments in all that you do. And that is the natural position of the living entity, because God is great and we are very small. And so our natural function is to serve Him. Like the hand or the finger is part of the body. So the natural function of the part is to serve the whole. The natural function of the hand is to serve the whole body. If the hand is not serving the body, it means it's diseased. There's something wrong. It's diseased. It's paralyzed. It's meant to serve the body. So when we do not serve God, we are considered to be in a diseased condition. And to the degree that human society does not serve God, which at the present time is to quite a large extent, the whole human society in a diseased condition. And we can see the symptoms of the disease manifest as so much lying, cheating, corruption, violence, and just an almost unlimited litany of discrepancies. So, given that every bona fide scripture will say that one should love God, what is the special feature of Krishna consciousness or the Bhagavad Gita that would lead one to read it, follow it? Well, the answer is very simple. The answer is that although every bona fide scripture will say that one should love God, we also need a practical process to develop our love for God. Because generally people, well, they love their bodies first and foremost, and then they love the expansions of their bodies, husband, wife, parents, children. And then they love the paraphernalia that gives comfort and pleasure to the body, the home, the car, I don't need to mention, but we all know very well. So that all makes sense in a way, but actually, in another way, it makes no sense. It's a very great blunder because we are not the body. But because we falsely identify with the body, we think that by pleasing the senses of the body, we will be happy. But we're not. Or we think that by pleasing the senses of other people's bodies, they'll be happy. And they also are not. And the politicians, they promise, you know, we'll please the senses of, we'll please your senses, we'll give you more sense gratification. But they can never satisfy the voters. And therefore, the voters kick them out and elect someone new. But the new party, they can't satisfy the voters either by material means. So the voters throw them out and on and on and on. Of course, there can be relative distinctions. Certainly there can be relative distinctions within the material world. But we're discussing in more absolute terms. So we are actually the soul, not the body. And the soul, which is really us, can be satisfied only in relation to the Supreme Soul. And the process by which the individual soul is connected to the Supreme Soul is yoga. The word yoga, the English word yoke, which means to join together, comes from the Sanskrit word yoga. So yoga really means the process by which the individual soul is linked or becomes connected to or reunited with the Supreme Soul. And the specific process, there are different types of yoga, but the only process that can actually connect one fully to the Supreme Soul and satisfy the individual self is bhakti yoga. And that's why it is important to understand what bhakti yoga is. So there is a very nice verse in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhaktir adhoksaje ahaituki apratihata yayatma su prasidati. Savai pung sang paro dharmo means the supreme occupation for the living entities, yato bhaktir adhoksaje, is that by which bhakti, one attains to bhakti, or one develops love for God. But that bhakti yoga, that bhakti, ahaituki, it should have no cause. In other words, there should be no material motivation. And apratihata, there should be no interruption. Yayatma supracedati, that can satisfy the self. That alone can satisfy the self. So, within every tradition, Hindu, Christian, Muslim, Jain, Jewish, there are pure practitioners And there are mixed practitioners. Pure means that their only desire is to purify their existence and serve God and please God. And mixed or impure means that they have material desires. They go to the church or the temple or the mosque to get something material from God. And even among religious people, the majority have material motives. That is, and that's in every tradition. In the Vedic tradition, of course, bhakti, Krishna, the worship of Vishnu, Krishna, in principle is meant to be pure. But there are so many worshippers of demigods, Shiva, Durga, Ganesh, and the worshippers want to get something material in return for their worship. And we find it in every other tradition as well. You know, give us this day our daily bread. Now that is good, actually, it's good because they are acknowledging God's supremacy, they're acknowledging their dependence on God. But actually, God is the Supreme Father. He is providing food for all of his children, whether we ask or not. In a way, it's very well-meaning, but if you think about it, it's sort of an insult. It's like, it would be as if a child were to tell his father in the morning, now, you know, you have to feed us, you know, now you really got to go to the office and bake some money so there'll be some bread on the table at night. Well, that's not very nice. I mean, the father knows what his duty is. He doesn't need his child to tell him. So the child, he doesn't have to worry. He's under the protection of the father. He just has to be obedient. If he's obedient, there's no question the father will take care of him in all respects. Now, sometimes it happens. I've seen it myself. Sometimes at the dinner table, there will be something that the little child likes a lot. And a good child, you know, sweet child, might say, "Oh, this tastes so good! You should taste this," you know. And the child might give a little of that preparation to the father. So that is the mood of offering food, like prasad. Everything that we offer to God, offer to the Father, is coming from Him. But it's out of love, like that small child who wants to offer something to the Father. It's all coming from the Father, but out of love he wants to offer it to the Father so the Father is happy, so he can share that happiness with the child. So our acharyas, especially Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, has said that a pure devotee can appreciate any religious tradition. Suppose say we are devotees of Krishna, but we can go to a church or a temple or a synagogue, and we can get spiritual inspiration. It happens on occasion that one does not find a temple or a house of worship within one's tradition, chosen or otherwise, but still one wants to be in a spiritual atmosphere. It happened. Sometimes I would visit my parents on the North Shore of Chicago, and I would want to chant someplace and get some spiritual inspiration. So I would walk to Tower Road, and I would walk out on a pier. And on a clear day, from that pier in a distance, there's like a very magnificent temple in Wilmette called the Baha'i Temple. So I would walk out on the pier, and I would look at the dome of the temple, and I get a little spiritual encouragement. There's so many examples which I... And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that it doesn't really matter what the religious tradition is, but there should be no materialistic desires. That's the critical factor. Where the worship is conducted in the mood of getting material benefits, or a step further, if you want to say, with the idea of merging and becoming one with God, with some light, some energy, then a pure devotee will not feel comfortable. He won't feel happy because he wants pure devotion. And but if he finds a place in any tradition where the mood of worship is pure, then he will feel very comfortable and happy in that association. And he will see the object of worship. Of course, the object of worship is God, but he will understand God in terms of his own worshipable Lord, that form of God or manifestation of God. So sometimes there's unnecessary controversy amongst followers of different traditions or worshipers of different deities. I myself have become embroiled in such needless controversy. One example that comes to mind is when I went to Madras in 1971. I was actually the first devotee from ISKCON to go to Madras. And in Madras, well, generally they are very proud, because they never came under the Muslim domination, so they feel that their culture has been preserved in a more pure way. And That's another thing. In every tradition, they're sort of like the, you could say the gyanis and the bhaktas. Even in Buddhism, I've seen the same thing in Buddhism. So anyway, in Madras, there are a lot of people who identify themselves as worshippers of Lord Shiva. And then there are the intellectuals who think they're above all these different deities, that God has no name, he has no form, but he comes in the name, in the form of Shiva or Durga or Ganesh or Vishnu. But ultimately behind the different forms is just this spiritual light, spiritual energy. So why this silly, childish, petty quarreling, you know, Shiva is supreme, Vishnu is supreme, actually I'm supreme. I mean, that's what it comes to. Why worry about them? You yourself can merge and become God. So, you know. So, anyway. So now there was one man in Madras named Mr. Ramakrishna. And people, I kept meeting people who would tell me, have you met Mr. Ramakrishna? He's very pious. He's very religious. You know, you should meet him. He'll certainly take interest in your activities. So I met him, and he came out, Shiva supreme. I said, Krishna supreme. And I had my evidence. I mean, that's the thing. I had actual evidence that Krishna is supreme. But he had his sentiment. He might have had his authorities. And it ended up being quite... He had a very volatile nature. He got like really red in the face and very agitated. So things did not end up on a very sweet note. So anyway, that's how it happens. Of course, I thought, did I do something wrong? Should I have presented things in a different way? You know, what did I do? Things ended up in such a conflict. So time passed. I kept meeting people. Have you met Mr. Ramakrishna? He's such a religious man. You must meet him. And I imagined that he was getting the same thing. Have you met the Hare Krishna devotee? They're doing very good work. You'll definitely be happy to see what they're doing. So I thought, okay, this is too much. So I phoned him, and he was very happy to arrange another appointment. I think he was getting the same thing. So this time we were careful. We didn't want to end in another conflict. So, you know, it started out in a friendly enough way, congenial enough way. And then he brought up this issue. Like, who's supreme? Well, you know, in this 2 weeks that we hadn't met, nothing had changed. I mean, Krishna was still supreme. So it's like, you know, God is not elected by popular votes. It's not like, okay, Krishna's in for for this term, and if people don't like him, then he gets voted out and someone... No, God is God. He's not subject to our votes, our likes or dislikes. So anyway, gradually it escalated. He got a little hotter, and I suppose I got a little hotter. And, but we didn't want it to end the way the last argument ended, but it was definitely going in that direction. And then I had an idea. I said, look, you know, I'm just a student. My teacher is coming to Madras. My guru is coming to Madras. Well, I can arrange for you to discuss with him. I think that will be much better. He said, yes, yes. Yes, I agree. That will be much better. So Srila Prabhupada came. And I invited Mr. Ramakrishna to meet him. And he said, Swamiji, I have been meeting with your student, Giriraj, and we are having a controversy. Who is supreme, Krishna or Shiva? And Srila Prabhupada dealt with this question in such an intelligent way that he took it to another platform. He didn't answer it within the categories that Mr. Ramakrishna had presented it. And he said that there are two words in Sanskrit, puja and bhakti. In puja, one worships the deity to get something in return. And in bhakti, one serves the deity only to please the deity without any expectation of personal gain. And then Srila Prabhupada said, but generally people approach Shiva in the mood of puja, to get something in return, and people approach Vishnu or Krishna in the mood of pure bhakti. So Mr. Ramakrishna said, and he gave the, yeah, so Mr. Ramakrishna said, well, can't there be exceptions? And Prabhupada said, yes, of course there can be. I mean, it may happen that someone goes to a liquor shop for some other purpose. Generally, people go to a liquor shop to get liquor to drink. But it could happen that one goes to a liquor shop for some other reason. I used to do that. Really, because in Boston, we would, in the evening, we'd go out on Boylston Street and chant. And the temple president was Satsvarupa Das, and he sort of ordered that we should come back every night at whatever, 8:30. But sometimes it was so good I didn't want to come back. And in those days there were no cell phones. We could never imagine such things then. And at Boylston Street, where we would chant, there weren't any pay phones on the street. But there was like a pub. And so I would go in and ask the proprietor if I could make a phone call. And then I would phone Satsvarupa and ask if we could stay out a little longer. But generally, if one goes to a liquor shop, it's understood that he's going to drink. So then Mr. Ramakrishna asked Srila Prabhupada, well, what if someone worships Shiva in the mood of bhakti, not in the mood of puja to get something? And Prabhupada said, that's fine. That's fine. And that was where Prabhupada left it. But something very mysterious or transcendental takes place. If one worships Shiva without any desire for return, just because one is seeking absolute knowledge or absolute bliss, Shiva will bring that devotee to Krishna. Yeah. And I know two very vivid examples. It's a principle, but one is Nityananda Prabhu, the temple president in Dallas. He was a Shaivite. Somehow he was a Shaivite. But not the materialistic type like many, but he just happened to be a Shaivite, and eventually Lord Shiva brought him to Krishna. And another is actually a professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara. She had been a student at Vassar, and they had a program where you would spend your junior year abroad. And she went to Varanasi. And there are many, big temple of Shiva in Varanasi. And by association, she became a worshiper of Shiva. But she didn't want anything material. She was looking for knowledge, absolute knowledge. She was looking for liberation from the cycle of birth and death. And eventually, anyway, it's a long story. She came back, became a professor, and started to meet devotees. First was Tamal Krishna Goswami, and then through him she met me, and she found that she was becoming a devotee of Krishna. But she was thinking, well, what about my devotion to Shiva? Am I being unchaste? Am I being unfaithful? And then I explained, it took a little time, but I explained that actually Shiva himself is a devotee of Krishna. Vaishnavanyam Yatashambhu, Lord Shiva is considered the greatest of Vaishnavas. And that to the contrary, Lord Shiva would be pleased if you became a devotee of Krishna. And then gradually, as she read Srimad Bhagavatam, she understood that actually that is the case. And even in other traditions, if one is sincerely seeking God, then God will help. Even if one gets that help from, quote, outside one's own tradition. And you don't have to give up, being a Hindu or Christian or Muslim or whatever it is, but you can add this. You can add this. And you become a better Hindu or Christian or Muslim or whatever it is. Of course, when you're really spiritually enlightened, you realize I'm not a Hindu or a Christian or a Muslim or a man or a woman or even a human being, or you realize that you're the soul. But still, realizing that you're the soul, you can continue within, you know, if circumstantially it may be that you continue in your cultural tradition, but you add the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita, you add the chanting of God's name. That chanting of God's name is in every tradition, practically every scripture. It's a big topic. But that's the truth. I would have very nice discussions with the Jewish rabbi at the temple in Santa Barbara. And I asked him, like, how do you feel? Like, if you meet a genuinely God conscious person, how do you feel, who's not Jewish, how do you feel? I mean, within your heart, how do you feel when you meet him or her? And he said, I feel very happy. I feel that this person is a blessing to the world, a genuinely God-conscious person. So anyone who's genuinely God-conscious, not materially motivated, not politically motivated, they'll feel happy when they meet another pure devotee in whatever tradition. So, yeah. But because of this sort of little more detailed scientific approach, people can benefit, you know, in whatever their practice by adding, if they wish. Can add the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita, add the chanting of God's name, whether the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra or the Jesus Prayer or Allah Allah. In Pakistan, I came across a book called The 99 Names of Allah. Like in the Hindu tradition, there's Vishnu Sahasranam, 1,000 names of Vishnu, so they have 99 names of Allah. And the book mentioned that the best thing that a pious Muslim can do at the time of death is to chant God's name. And the best things that his family members and friends can do is to help him chant God's name. And it's exactly the same as in the yoga tradition, but Krishna consciousness, exactly the same as in Krishna consciousness, same in the Jewish tradition, that when the friends and family chant, like, it's something like, you could say, the Maha Mantra of the Jewish tradition. And it's very similar. Both of my parents left their bodies in that circumstance with almost all of their family members around them chanting that. And there was something very, very special that happened in my mother's case. We could see that the time was coming. You can see their symptoms. And at that time, His Holiness Radhanath Swami was in New York at the ISKCON Temple in Brooklyn. And I phoned him. I wanted him to know. And So I found this out later. So he was just about to go into the temple room, big temple room, and lead kirtan and give this the talk. And I later found out that just at that time when my mother actually left her body, which, and she was like surrounded by almost all the family and chanting, he announced to the hundreds of devotees who had gathered there that Girad Swami's mother is in the process of leaving her body. So everyone should pray for her. And he dedicated that kirtan to her. And when I found out later, I realized that she actually left her body. Of course, we were chanting around her in our own way, and all these hundreds of devotees in New York were also chanting for her at the same time. So that was very encouraging. It was very encouraging. So we really, you know, in a way, all we really have is each other. I mean, we have God, we have Krishna, we have the holy name, we have the scriptures, we have the deities, we have the temples. But what really makes the difference is the association. The association. And that is so precious and valuable. You never want to take it for granted. Like last night we discussed a little that Krishna disappeared from the gopis in order to increase their love for him, to increase their attachment for him. And he gave the example that if someone is very poor and he suddenly comes into a lot of money, and then he loses that money, he'll be thinking of that money all the time. Like sometimes we have our chanting beads. They're very important. Srila Prabhupada said your beads are your link to Krishna. So we have our chanting beads. But we might not always be so conscious of them. Then we put them somewhere and we forget where we put them. And we think that someone might have stolen them. Or not stolen them, taken them. And then we can do nothing but think of them. Where are my beads? Where are my beads? Where are my beads? So it's like that. Krishna may remove himself from you to increase your anxiety for him. Now, to be bereft of the association of devotees means like-minded seekers of God or followers of God is the worst situation that you could be in. So you don't want to take that association for granted, because otherwise you might lose it. I mean, Krishna might take it away to teach you the value of it, so you don't take it for granted in the future. I'm aware of a very tragic, you know, but a devotee, he's not initiated, but he, it was one of those things, he was from India, he had a job in information technology. He lost his job. Now, when he had his job, he was going to the temple, you know, definitely every Sunday and many mornings. Many mornings he would go to the temple. When he lost his job, I mean, yeah, he sort of became depressed, but more than that, he lost the structure to his life. So instead of taking advantage of the opportunity, okay, don't have to go to work, I can go to the temple, he started to sleep late in the morning. He just became very loose in his habits. And as he describes it, he just sunk deeper and deeper into tamagun. And under the influence of tamagun, the ignorance, the darkness, he did something that he should not have done, something against the law that he should not have done. And as a result, the temple banned him. So, okay, he's facing the court case. But that's the small part to him. The big part is the association. Like, he's being denied. Of course, it's not as black and white as that, but at least the facility of going to the temple to get association is denied to him. And it's also understandable, because if he did something like that at the temple could be legally liable, because they know that he did that, has that tendency. So, you know, he is lamenting day and night. He can't go to the temple, he can't have the association of devotees. So we don't want to take for granted any gift that God has given us. Because if we take it for granted and become neglectful, he might take it away from us. And then we'll really have to work hard to get it back. And we don't even know when or how we will get it back. So we should always be very humble and aware of our weakness and the need we have for each other, for the encouragement we get from each other, for the good advice we get from each other. Okay, sometimes it happens. Devotee forgets to turn off his cell phone. To err is human. We all make mistakes. But to err is human, and to forgive is divine. We shouldn't... Oh, Maharaj is giving a talk. You didn't even think to turn off your cell phone. I mean, we should be very forgiving. You know, we should see the good and overlook little defects. And then our association with each other will be very congenial. And that will please Krishna. That will please Krishna. There are many examples, even from sort of common wisdom and folklore. Like there's the story of, I don't remember the context, maybe it was a father instructing his sons, and he had some sticks, some small sticks, say he had, I'm just making it up, say he had 8 sons. So he had 8 sticks, and he gave each one a stick and asked them to break the sticks. Easily they could break the individual sticks. But if, when he put all the sticks together and bound them and then asked them to break, they couldn't do it. So that's the idea that in unity there's strength. And another example that Srila Prabhupada gave was sort of the contrary example, that the father was very sick. And the sons gathered together, what did I say, 4 sons gathered together to massage the father. So one was massaging the right hand, one was massaging the left hand, one was massaging the right foot or leg, one was just sort of doing the left foot or leg. And then the one on the left leg decided, why should I be doing the leg? You know, I should be doing the arm. So he starts, you know, with the other brother, look, you know, I should be doing the arm, you do the leg, I should be doing the arm. And they start fighting. And then the one doing the left arm thinks, why should I be doing the left arm? I should be doing the right arm. And he tells the other one, hey, look, I should be doing the right arm. And then they start fighting. And while the sons are fighting over who should be massaging which part of the father's body, the father dies. So we don't want to be in that situation. We're here to like serve the body of Krishna, of Prabhupada. So we don't want to be fighting over who is doing which service. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're doing the leg or the arm or the neck or the head or the right side or the left side. What matters is that the father gets a good experience and he gets some healing and nurturing energy. That's what matters. It doesn't matter who's doing what. So that should be our mood. Like with the gopis are not thinking, you know, I want to be with Krishna. But the gopis are thinking, especially of Srimati Radharani, that Srimati Radharani is the best of us. She should be with Krishna. That will make Krishna more happy. And Radharani is thinking, oh, these other gopis are so nice. Krishna should be with them. So they want to arrange for Radharani to be with Krishna. And Radharani wants to arrange for them to be with Krishna. So this is the mood of selfless service, devotion. And that's the mood we should cultivate among ourselves, and that will be very pleasing to Guru and Krishna. So I think that's... I mean, I know Gauranga had his idea of what I should speak on. And I will try to satisfy him. I will. I have no choice. But I think So should I, we take questions on this and then go to that, or go to that and, huh? What other answer would I have expected? He says we can skip the questions and go to the stories. All right. So, oh yes, if there is an end. So in from the last installment, we'd come to Sea Palace Hotel. Was that after going to Amritsar and Delhi and Surat? Okay. So in Surat, one of my god brothers, Rishi Kumar, he called me aside, very, very like hushed tones, a very confidential mood, and he said that Srila Prabhupada is introducing a new program in India called Life Membership, and anyone who enlists life members will please Srila Prabhupada very much. So like we read, the whole purpose of bhakti is to please Krishna, but we don't really know how to please Krishna. In a sense, we have to know from the guru. And if we please the guru, then Krishna will be pleased. So that was, oh, wow, you know, it's a chance to please Prabhupada. So I said, okay, I'll come. So at that time, we didn't have any center in Bombay. We were completely new in India. But we had a friend named Ramchand Chabria who had a hotel on Strand Road. Just where the Taj is, where the Great Gateway of India is, there's a row of hotels. And he had one called the Sea Palace Hotel. But he was Vaishnav, he was a devotee. He knew devotees from England. Very nice man, very pious man. And his hotel was vegetarian. The whole hotel was vegetarian, which I would say took some faith and conviction, because he had to compete, and no alcohol, you know, no meat and no alcohol, and he had to compete with, but anyway, it was a nice hotel, and he was doing well enough, and so he gave us some rooms at the top. I think they were being renovated, the work wasn't done. Anyway, we had these rooms at the top. And there were some, so Shyam Sundar Prabhu, Prabhupada's senior disciple, Shyam Sundar Prabhu, he was there. He was in charge. And Yadubara, at that time, he was John. He was a photographer. He was on assignment in India to take photographs, and he met Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, you know, he was asking where could he get good themes for his photography. And Prabhupada said, you can go to Vrindavan. and so John went to Vrindavan to take photos, and he fell in love with Vrindavan. And, but he didn't, we could all see that he was a devotee, that he was becoming, but he couldn't see it. But that was okay, that was okay. So he came down to the Sea Palace Hotel. He was staying there. He converted the bathroom into a dark room. Yeah, and he would be hanging up his negatives. I don't remember how that technical process works, but so he was there, and, you know, Rishi Kumar was there, and Some of the ladies were there. I think Malati, yes, of course, Malati. Malati was there. So, Shamsundar, you know, he gave me a little advice how to enroll life members. And then he gave me a piece of paper with a name and address on it. And he said, this is, you go here and you make him a member and you tell me what happens. And like, I'll see how you do and then I'll give you more. So I went. He had a big office at Churchgate. His name was S.N. Nagpal, Nagpal Ambadi Petro Refining Corporation. So I explained everything, and at the end I asked him to become a life member. He said, I have to consult my brother. I said, okay, that seemed reasonable enough. So should I phone you, or, you know, how should we do it? He said, I'll phone you. So, you know, I went back, I told Shamsundar. He said, what? You didn't make him a life member? I could have made him a life member. I said, well, he said he wanted to consult his brother. He said, oh, that's just an excuse. That's just an excuse. He could have become a life member himself. He didn't need to consult his brother. And anyway, I learned some very interesting things. He said, if someone doesn't agree, it means they have some doubt. But they won't tell you what the doubt is. You have to be intelligent enough to figure out what the doubt is without them even expressing it. And you have to speak and act in such a way that the doubt is removed. And then voluntarily they will agree. A little later, he sent me out with Madhuvisa Prabhu to an office at Flora Fountain, and I saw that in action. The man had already agreed to become a life member. So Madhuvisa came to collect the check and give him the books. And the man had changed his mind. He didn't want to give the check. But Madhuvisa Prabhu didn't say, you promised, you know, we came all the way here, you can't go back. But just like what Shamsundar said, he was thinking, he has some doubt. He has some reservation. You know, we have to understand what is his reservation and remove it. So it was a little above my head. I don't know what the doubt was or how it all worked. But without mentioning anything about life membership or having doubts or questions, it seemed that Madhuvisa was just talking to him, just discussing. And after a while, without Madhuvisa saying anything about life membership, the man said, all right, I'll become your life member. And I thought, oh, that's how it works. You know, that's how it's meant to work. That's how it's meant to work. So, but anyway, eventually Mr. Nagpal, he became a member. I guess he spoke to his brother or whatever, or maybe spoke to some other people to find out more about us. Then when his doubts were removed, he but there was another thing about me, that I was always very afraid of Maya. And like even in the Boston Temple, I wouldn't want to, I wouldn't want to go out on the street alone, walk on the sidewalk alone, because I thought I might get tempted to look at a billboard or something, and that would be Maya, that would be a distraction from my Krishna consciousness. So I was always very fearful. So I didn't like the idea of going out like that. And this was like bothering me. I was going out a little bit and coming back, but it was bothering me. But eventually I sort of learned how to deal with Indian people and how to make life members. But this thing of going out in the city and so many sights and sounds and smells and signs and just so many distractions, I was very fearful. So one day I got in an auto rickshaw to come from the Sea Palace Hotel to Hanuman something near the Small Causes Court, sort of near Metro Cinema, Hanuman something, Hanuman Lane, Old Hanuman Lane. Yeah, Old Hanuman Lane. So I had an appointment, I think, with a cloth merchant down there. But anyway, I was sitting in the auto rickshaw chanting really intensely, really seriously. And suddenly I had this revelation that I could be back in the temple chanting and getting some benefit. But I'm chanting in the auto rickshaw. I'm getting the same benefit from the chanting. But beyond the benefit of the chanting, I'm meeting people and engaging them in Krishna's service and helping to establish the mission. So this is better. This is better. I get the same benefit of the chanting, but on top of it, I get to meet people and engage people in Krishna's service. So that was a major breakthrough for me, like a major breakthrough. So I mean, that's just like the first few days at the Sea Palace Hotel, but I think that's what our time allows. Is that all right? Gauranga Prabhu. Okay, thank you. But it was very interesting. I mean, this won't take long. This is such a short thing. That eventually Prabhupada came from Surat, and the other devotees from Surat came, including Yamuna Devi. And she was sitting in Prabhupada's room at the Sea Palace Hotel, and there was a sound of a peacock in the distance. And she said, Srila Prabhupada, it's just like Vrindavan. Did you hear that? It's just like Vrindavan. You can hear the sound of the peacocks. So, yeah, I guess we've... I mean, just being with Prabhupada was like being in Vrindavan, but hearing a peacock in the distance was an added touch. And we took walks in that whole area, near the Gateway of India, and there's some photographs of that. Yeah. I'm trying to avoid confronting the fact that the time is up and I'm going to have to stop, so I keep... But all right, let's see. Do any of you have any questions or comments?
Yes.
Do any of you have any questions or comments?
Hari bol, in Rigveda it is said ekam sat vipra bahudha vadanti, means the supreme truth is spoken by different nationalities in different names like Allah, Krishna, Jesus. So if the ekam sat is pronounced, the is one, like vipra ekam sat vipra means in Rigveda it is said, so why we fight amongst ourselves, like means Muslim, Hindu, and like Uttam Adhikari are the best, and like Madhyam Adhikari fight on some topics, like philosophical debates happen and all such. Even like they fight on, like violence happens between the followers.
That's a good question. He says, according to the Vedas, God is one, but he's referred to by different names in different languages. So why do people fight? Well, this fighting, and you made a good point, that there are different levels of advancement of devotees. There's the kanistas. They're actually still on the material platform. And then there are the advanced devotees, the Madhyam Bhaktas. They're on the spiritual platform, more or less on the spiritual platform. And then there are the perfect devotees, the Mahabhagavatas. They're on the spiritual platform and they've realized God. So on the material platform, people fight. You know, that's just the nature of people in the bodily concept. Like Srila Prabhupada gave the example, if you put a bunch of cats, he was talking about the United Nations, that if you have a beautiful room with plush chairs and you fill the room with cats and dogs, and you tell them to make peace, will they be able to make peace? So the answer is, what's the answer? No. And why will they be unable to make peace? Because they're cats and dogs. Because they're animals. So according to higher knowledge, according to Vedic literature, anyone who identifies with the body is an animal. So as long as people identify with the body, they will fight. And this disease is everywhere. Everyone thinks they're better than others. They identify with the body and they think they're better. The Americans think, we're Americans, we're the best. And the Indians think, we're Indians, we're the best. And the Chinese think, we're Chinese, we're the best. And they fight. So, and there's no limit. It's not just Hindus and Muslims or Muslims and Jews. Even within Christians, they fight. Even within Muslims, they fight. So, we people have to come to the spiritual platform. It's the only solution. That requires education, requires knowledge, and it requires some spiritual discipline. Because we might have spiritual knowledge. Everyone in this room, well, many people in this room know in theory, I'm not the body. We have the theoretical knowledge, I'm not the body. But if someone steps on our toe, we become very angry. Hey, you stepped on my toe. What's the matter with you? What are you getting so upset for? You're not the body. Who are you to tell me I'm not the body? You're also not the body. It's like we have the theoretical knowledge, but we don't have the actual realization. And that realization comes from practice, from spiritual discipline, from the chanting, Cheto Darpano Marginam. The chanting cleanses the dust from the mirror of the mind. If a mirror is covered with dust, you can't see yourself in the mirror. You don't know who you are. You can't see anything. But if you wipe away the dust, you can see who you are. So the mirror of the mind is covered with dust. Dust means ignorance. Thinking, the basic misconception is I'm the body. And so the chanting cleanses that dust. And then we realize I'm not the body, I'm the soul within the body. And the soul cannot be cut or wet or burnt or withered. The soul is beyond all of that. So no one can really hurt you. I mean, they could hurt the body, but they can't really hurt you. But that's not a justification for hurting the body. We should not, it's also a principle of a devotee that he should not give pain to any living entity. So, but if it happens that someone accidentally or even purposely causes us some pain, we shouldn't, anyway, that's a little complicated if someone does it on purpose, but even if they do it on purpose in a way they can't help it, because they themselves are just being controlled by the material nature. So at the end, Jesus Christ said, "Forgive them, Lord, they know not what they do." So we should try to have that attitude if someone harms us. But if someone offends Krishna or a devotee, that's something different. For ourselves, we should be meek and humble, but for the sake of others, we should be prepared to defend them. Just to give an example, sort of a humorous example, but one of my good friends in devotional service is Ritattvaja Swami. And he, when he was young, he used to, he and another devotee would go to the Florida Welcome Center. And when people would drive in to the Florida Welcome Center, he would greet them. He might give them a flower, give them a book, you know, ask for a donation. And sometimes people just didn't like us. You know, they had some prejudice, maybe some people. So anyway, this big guy started to sort of pick on him. And he was like 5'6". And at that time, I don't know, he probably weighed 120 pounds or something. He's like a little guy. This big guy starts picking on him, like, What are you doing here? What are you bothering people for? Just leave us alone. Just go away. And the other devotee he was distributing with was a big black devotee who was 6 feet 6 tall. So while this guy was picking on Ritattvaja Swami, Vaninath comes over and he taps the guy on the shoulder. He's like looking down at him. He says, "You have a problem with my friend? You have a problem with me." So the idea is that we should, personally we can be meek and humble, but we should protect the deity, we should protect the devotees. Ratanaja Swami, I mean, what the devotees did in the early days is amazing. He told me another story that it was the same type of, there was, you know how it is, there's always friends and enemies in the material world. Anyway, somehow this guy came out of the welcome center. Maybe someone had spoken to him inside and said, "You don't even know what they say, like that we eat small babies or whatever it was." But when he came out, he was so angry, you know, just based on what he'd heard about us. So this guy approached Ratanaja Swami again, like 5'6", 120 pounds, real little guy. And Vaninath wasn't there. And this guy, this big, like, burly guy, comes up to him. And he starts pushing him. And I don't know, Krishna just gave him the intelligence. And he took off his book bag, put it on the ground. He said, "Man, you want to fight with me? I'm ready. I didn't spend 6 years in the Marines, in the Green Berets, to get pushed around by someone like you." And he stamped his foot on the ground. He said, "Come on, you want to fight? I'm ready to fight with you right here and now." And the man's wife grabbed hold of his arm. He said, "Honey, honey, he's been in the Marines." You don't want to mess with him. Let's get out of here. Just leave him alone. Let's just get out of here. And it was like Krishna's mercy, because if he'd taken him up on that challenge, oh my God, we don't know what would have happened. But yeah, Krishna, he empowers devotees and inspires devotees. There were a lot of good stories from the Florida guest reception center. I hope we can get Ratanaja Swami to come and tell you the stories. I mean, I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, they're so funny. Such funny stories. And, you know, it's like, he would give people flowers, but one day they ran out of flowers. But what they would do is they would buy flowers on long stems. So they'd given away all the flowers, all they had left was the stems. So they started approaching people with the stems. they say, "Welcome to Florida, sir. Have one of these." He said, "Well, what do I do with this?" He said, "Well, whatever you like." and people were taking them and, you know, giving donations. We'd give them a book. So then after a while, Mabel, she's like the lady inside the guest reception, like a sort of a heavy set lady. She comes storming out with her hands on her hips. He said, "What are you guys doing? What are you all doing? You giving them these useless stems? And they come into my guest center and they drop them stems on the floor and I have to pick them up? You stop this." Anyway, so many adventures. So finally, there were many encounters. Sometimes police would come. But anyway, final encounter was on Christmas. They came dressed as Santa Claus. And the sheriff came. The devotees knew the sheriff because someone filed a completely false case against them. It was very interesting. They filed a completely false case again. I could tell you that too, but anyway. So the judge, he could immediately see through it, and he not only did he dismiss the case, but he chided the sheriff, and he said, "Don't ever bring these kind of cases to me again. These people are innocent." And that was a completely false case. Don't insult me and this courtroom by bringing these people in on these false charges. So even though he was sort of chided by the judge, but you know how it is, he just didn't like the devotees. So he came, he approached Ratutvaja Swami dressed as Santa Claus, and he said, "You can't do this. You can't do this. You have to take that off, that costume off. You have to leave this place. I'm not allowing you to do that here." So Ratutvaja Swami said, "Well, what law am I violating?" So the sheriff said, "You're impersonating Santa Claus." So Ratutvaja Swami said, "Okay, you bring the real Santa Claus and I'll take it off." Of course. So anyway, I guess the idea is that devotees went through a lot to pioneer this movement, and they faced a lot of opposition, a lot of awkward situations, but Krishna gave them the intelligence. It was same in Juhu, same in so many parts of the world. So that spirit of being ready to do anything to please Guru and Krishna, that was the spirit that prevailed in the early days of ISKCON. That should be the spirit now. Of course, we're more established now, so we wouldn't have to do some of the things we did in the early days to begin things. But yeah, we should have that mood of being ready to take risks for Guru and Krishna. Sometimes in devotee circles, we come across different opinions, different understandings, or different levels of consciousness. How should one approach such situations to serve better? Serve the mission in the association of devotees. Well, we're all individual. It's natural that we'll have different opinions. It's not a problem if we have different opinions. If it's a matter of what's the best way to serve Krishna, you can discuss. But the main thing is that it's very rare that any difference is worth disrupting the relations. Generally it's better. It's all for Krishna. I mean, I remember very early I was driving. And there was a question which way to go. So one devotee said, turn right. And another devotee said, turn left. And the senior devotee who was in the car, the devotee who said turn right was correct, and that the devotee who said turn left was also correct. So I said, how could they both be correct? And she said, because the devotee who said to turn right was thinking how to serve Krishna in the best way. And the devotee who said to turn left was also thinking how to serve Krishna in the best way. So they're both right. And probably we'll ultimately get to the destination anyway, whether you turn right first and then left, or left first and then right. So we have to adjust. Yeah, I'll end with one story, sort of on that theme. Once at the Ardha Kumbha Mela, there was a little dispute between Yamuna Devi and Maruvisa Prabhu. Maruvisa said that there's no difference between Krishna and Balaram, except that Krishna is blackish and Balaram is whitish. And Yamuna Devi said there is a difference because only Krishna is the enjoyer of Radharani. So they were sort of arguing back and forth, and Tamal Krishna Goswami decided to take the matter to Srila Prabhupada. And he said, you know, Maruvisa Prabhu said there's no difference between Krishna and Balaram, except that Krishna is blackish complexion and Balaram is whitish complexion. And Prabhupada said, yes, he is right. And then Tamal Krishna Goswami said, but Yamuna Devi says there is another difference, which is that Krishna is the only enjoyer of Radharani. And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, she is right. And Tamal Krishna Goswami said, but they're both saying different things. They can't both be right. And Prabhupada said, yes, you are right. And then Tamal Krishna Goswami said, well, then which is right? And Srila Prabhupada said, you decide. So, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Hitai Gaur Premanandi Hari Bol.
Let us express our gratitude to His Holiness Giriraj Swami Maharaj and request Him to come again and again to Sri Sri Radha Gopinath Mandir Chopati to inspire and enliven all the devotees. Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol!